Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another Redshirt Friday edition of Rural Route, the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, Neil, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between food producers and food consumers coming to us from the worthless nut state. Neil Ronimus. Fortunately, I got to see Neil and his beautiful wife last week at the World Pork Expo. He was on a little tour of the Midwest, I reckon. How are you, Neil?
Oh, really good, Trent. Great to be here.
And I hear you locked on to some rain and pulled it back to the east.
Yes, we got 2.5 inches all gathered this weekend. We needed it. So we're good.
I have you like in the southwest quadrant. Is that correct?
That's correct. We live between Cincinnati and Columbus.
Yeah. Trying to think of the farm name I spoke at there years ago. That was a good time. Anyway, what'd you learn at the World Pork Expo?
Learned I don't have enough money to buy some of this equipment. Actually, it was a good time. Got to meet with a lot of people I hadn't seen for a while and some new products, and just got a way to enjoy some good company, good food.
So anytime we gather like that, it's the fellowship, the food, and the camaraderie that really drives us to do that. But, Neil, I have missed very few World Pork Expos in 35 years, and I didn't miss any really until 2020 and things went haywire. But I have to say that through all the ASF years, African swine fever years, through all the PED years, through all the even the $8 hogs in December of 1998, I've never seen the attitudes less optimistic about the future of pork industry than I saw last week. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I guess I'd agree with that. You know, there's a lot of things going out there on the market to pull the market in the wrong direction. Topics you spoke to about the proposition, California and Massachusetts and all that coming to a head finally. And I'm kind of agreeing with you on your stance there, because I think those markets should emerge on their own. You know, if they voted to keep those propositions, then let them deal with it. Somebody will make money in the long run, the local producers, you know, regional. So I'm of that opinion as well, Trent.
So for the radio audience, across the pond this morning, that hopefully you caught anyway, but just in case you didn't, Bryson Miller doesn't get up that early, so we got to share this story. Proposition 12 in California was about telling pork producers and egg layers and chicken breeders how much space and how they need to take care of their animals. The Supreme Court said, no, the rest of the industry can't tell California what to do. Proposition 12 is going to stand, which will forever change how the consumer interacts and tells the producer what they're going to do to comply with whatever rule they want. Now we have a set of 11 Republican governors who are trying to get Congress to enact an old act, which is called the Exposing Agricultural Trade Suppression Act, to force California to take pork and eggs from farmers no matter what they do, how they raise them, which I agree with. They should raise them how they want. Farmers are the true experts. And I disagree with the fact that we need to continue to tell California what to do. If you are a enthusiast for states' rights, Neil, you have to be an enthusiast for states' rights in all things, not just the things that you like.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. You know, we face some of those states' rights issues in Ohio all the time. We're a ballot initiative state. And in our fall, in our special election in August, we're going to place on the ballot to change our constitution in Ohio from a 51% majority to a 60, I believe, percent majority. So some of these ballot initiatives, such as California has placed on, it'd be harder for that to pass those when they bring outside money from other states to tackle an issue and get it passed. So that's kind of how we face those same things. If the states want it, let them have it. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, let them pay for it. And the market will emerge if the government leaves it alone, I feel.
I have all, yeah, I agree with you 100%. But we've been so far from that. Government thinks they have to intervene. And in this case, it's government that typically people talk about less government, and yet they're trying to create more government to get what they want. You can't be hypocritical.
Right. And locally in Ohio, we're facing the solar farms, they call it, which they aren't a farm. But recently I've heard a lot of upper level feds saying we need to rein in these local governments and make them comply with the renewable energy standards. Well, in Ohio, our local commissioners have decided that they do not want large scale solar projects in our county. So going from there, we face issues like that. And there they go, the feds or even the state levels trying to squash what the local people want.
That is when tyranny shows its ugly head and its true colors right there.
Absolutely.
Which is
Rein
why,
in.
ironically, Jesse Knight is my guest today on Trent on the Loose. He is now a county commissioner in Coffee County, Kansas, and they have issued six resolutions, which are all to this point, Neil. And the one resolution that caught my attention was that they took a stand against the EPA trying to put a new level of restrictions in small meatpacking plants, which would ultimately force most of them out of business. It's not like, Neil, that they don't have regulations. 1974 was the first set of standards for environmental quality. And then in 2008, they were renewed, updated, made more stringent. And now they're talking about doing it again. And it's a 2-year point. This is the federal government trying to rein in local control and local living and feeding people locally, and instead of all these global conglomerates.
Actually, in Ohio, our state is moving. We are having a lot of money put into local and regional processing plants. It's really gaining some ground here since COVID started. So that's a good thing in our area where our state is helping get that local food connection.
But you're exactly right. And do you know where that money stems from?
Okay, let's hear it.
The Inflation Reduction Act. The federal government is
Oh.
funneling money through your state Department of Agriculture, and it's happening in every state, to try to build the infrastructure of the local small butcher shops. We need more regional food systems. That's what they said through the Inflation Reduction Act. So they're giving money to local butcher shops and meat shops to expand. And when they expand, guess what happens? Then they have to meet these new EPA regulations. It's almost like, here, take this money and go do something so we can put more regulation on you. The two things are tied. And it's like, see what the left hand is doing to the right hand.
Yeah, I do.
Well, Ohio is such an interesting state to me. And I got to be honest with you, I feel your pain most days because Ohio is still a great agricultural and beyond agriculture, a great resource manufacturing state. And yet the East Coast mentality has been invading you as long as I've been coming there on a regular basis. I don't know how you maintain that composure, Neil.
It is. We have a large population of livestock facilities and we fight issues with the green algae. They're blaming us and we are actually working to alleviate some of that and they've made progress, and then we find out some of the municipalities are causing the worst problems, but it's always shoved on our backs, and large population, like you said, from the east. And we are a highly populated state, and that just kind of sometimes it works with you, sometimes it works against you.
Yeah, that's the challenge. When you live in a highly populated state and you have a lot of agricultural production, you're close to your customer, which is a good thing. But then you have
It
that whole
is.
California mentality of the customer telling you, "Hey, wait a minute, you can't make this air smell a little different today. You just cut this hay and this there's an odor in the air. I don't like what I smell. You need to stop cutting hay." Neil Ronimus, my guest, roll route. We'll take a break. We will be back with more Red Shirt Friday and talk about energy sources other than what is reliable. More after this. Well, another Redshirt Friday upon us. Neil doing a great job walking us through some basics of agriculture in Ohio. If you'd like to join me and say thank you to the local hometown heroes, then go to thewalloftheoffhonor.org, thewalloftheoffhonor.org. Full details about the individuals. Well, here's the deal. Full details about anybody who's been submitted. So if you have a loved one you'd like to have submitted to the Wall of Honor, go to thewalloftheoffhonor.org. If you'd like to donate to make sure this cause continues, go to thewalloftheoffhonor.org. And if you would like to get this particular monitor with a black box and all of these local heroes in your establishment, go to this other place, thewalloftheoffhonor.org. Three strikes, you're out. It's about saying thank you to those men and women who've enabled our freedom until now. TheWalloftheOffhonor.org for the proper honor. Welcome back. Roll Route. Trent Lewis on a Redshirt Friday. I got a couple stains on my red shirt, too. That's what happens when you wear them, Neil. Neil Ronimus joining me from Ohio. Last time you joined me, we went down this whole history of pork production and breeders and Berkshire hogs. That I could do that every day. I'm not sure the people listening want to hear that every day. You are also in the contract side of production on the pork business. How's that going for you?
Oh, it's pretty good. We live on a fixed income when you're a contract producer. So you have to manage your operational costs and your repairs, 22 years now, and I'm kind of reducing my operation a little bit. I always say I'm not in the expansion mode. I'm in the exit mode, but we're going to continue this for a while, and we'll be marking about 10,000 gilts every year. So we'll keep about that level and keep going best we can.
Neil, probably the most concerning thing I heard at the World Pork Expo, and this came from a construction entity, that there was currently 1 million pig spaces sitting empty in the pig world with be finished barns like you have, and they project that by the end of the year there could be another 1 million empty. What do you think's behind that?
Well, in my area, we'd like to have a few more. Construction costs are kind of prohibiting any new building from my standpoint and what we do. So we don't see that, but I've heard, as you said, out to the west, and Iowa particularly has a lot of empty spaces. I think we still have the pigs here to fill them. But, like I said, I'm one little link in the chain over here.
Production. What's the general attitude of the Eastern Corn Belt farmer this year right now with the way things are?
I don't know if they've really hit home yet that we produced a crop that costs us more than we have ever. I'm not in a lot of those large circles to pick up on it, but I think they're concerned about the size of the crop. And on the feed side, that's kind of a good thing. A smaller crop will help. A larger crop will help feed costs. But on the other end, there's red ink every day in the pork production system right now, I think.
I don't understand that either, Neil. I think that there's market manipulation taking place, because let's just look at what we know. We know that the inventory is low. We know that I just said there's 1 million pig spaces. We see reports of the largest pork producer going to sell 190,000 sows this year, which is forcing sow prices up. The big sow is worth 550 or a 550 pound sow is worth 17 cents, less than 20 cents right now. Put that into context. They were 70 cents not that long ago. And when they were 70 cents, Neil Trent said, Kelly, it's time to do a little herd reduction. And that looks like a good move. But my point is that we have what is supposedly a shorter inventory. And yet when you go to the retail case, we see that chicken is higher than typical, beef is higher than typical, and the retail pork prices are unbelievably low. None of that from a sheer economic standpoint, supply and demand, makes any sense to this old cowboy. Can you put logic to that?
I really can't, because I don't see why you wouldn't buy that $1.99 loin, put it in your freezer, cut it up, make a lot of meals. Ohio pork, we are all the time toting those ideas and try to get people to, you know, buy more pork that way. You know, the bacon's out of sight, but everything else is really cheap, like you said. So I just don't know. You know, I get up every day and I take care of pigs. I open the barn doors, I look and I smell and I listen to what's going on in the barn. And I'm not exposed to the other side of that market too much. You know, I focus every day on animal pig care, individual pig care, you know, and those things. So I kind of get lost in the realm of things because, as I said, I live on a fixed income. You know, I get paid so much every month for my use of my buildings and my labor as one. You know, we get paid by the spaces we operate. So I'm focused on construction costs, repair costs, and cost of energy, which is really crazy now for a double wide hog barn. You know, operates, those fans run all night long this time of year. So you're really cranking up a big electric bill. So when you get down into the economics, you know, that's kind of not my area. That's up to the man that writes the check for me every week, month.
That's fair enough. And you said something that I really want to build on because you said you look and you hear for what's going on in that barn. And you can clearly see things, but maybe the most important sense, particularly in the pig world, I don't think it's much different in the cattle world because I can tell this morning when I got up and walked over to do across the pond at 6:30, there was a cow bawling, which tells me she didn't know where her calf's at the moment. And I can walk out to the barn. I can hear lids on pig feeders, and I can tell, oh, I should have ordered feed yesterday. That's stockmanship. That's animal husbandry. And that is exactly what we were talking about in the first segment, where we have somebody in a cubicle trying to design an animal welfare program, and they don't have the first clue of what you and I were just talking about in terms of what you hear that leads to better animal husbandry. Can you expand upon
Exactly.
that?
Exactly. No, I can't. You did it quite well. I mean, every day it's a dairy farmer, a hog farmer, poultry, anybody that's around animals. In my case, a hog barn is really a piece of equipment to me. You know, it has to be running on all cylinders, ventilation, water, and everything. And, you know, a slight little cough somewhere, you hear that cough, you know. I don't have the feeder lids banging, but that used to be a good sound around here, the thunk and the clink of feeder lids, but, you know, are they active? And I don't care who you are, it's all about the animal. And as you said, that's what we do. And we do it as good as anybody in the world.
What Neil said for the non-livestock producer, my pigs are outside in dirt lots, so obviously I have a lid. His pigs are in a completely controlled environment. They're spoiled. His pigs are totally spoiled compared to mine, who live out in the weather. And those feeders do not have lids, so he doesn't have the feeder lids banging. I just thought we'd go through that little delineation,
Yeah.
but this, I don't know how we change this animal welfare thing other than just continue to do what we're doing and explain it at a level that people realize what you just described is a stockman. And that's what we need. We need stockmen.
I heard you say this once before that there's teaching animal science. They changed the name. It should be animal husbandry and stockmanship. You know, it's a science in itself, but you get a more human connection, I believe, when you talk about husbandry versus science.
I'm told that the animal science universities of the world, like that little bitty one you have there, the Ohio State University, I am told they changed from animal husbandry degrees to animal science degrees in 1959. That was kind of like the
Before our time.
movement, but kind of like the movement in the land grant, right? So before our time.
Well, we could do a whole day on land grant colleges now and how they've strayed. And I don't care if it is the one. There's a lot of them that are following the same path.
We won't do a whole day, but how about we do a minute and a half? Well, how do we fix the land grant university system?
Well, I didn't attend a college. You know, I sent my children to some. They need to connect with what's really going on. You know, they need to be more connected. Some of them have let their farms go, you know, their academic farms just go so far down. I haven't toured very many of them, but I hear this often times, you know, it's all about, you got 1,000 people in a lecture hall talking and they're learning. So that hands-on ATI seems to be a good start in our state, you know, and here locally we have the Wilmington College. They're a very liberal Quaker college, but yet they have a farm, an academic farm still to this day, and they turn out some pretty good kids. It's the only the second other place that you can get an ag degree in Ohio, I believe.
Really? You know, you bring up something that needs to have an analysis because through my 20 years of being engaged in these battles, we've been a part of universities getting rid of their hands-on research farms because they wanted to be more involved in research than extension and yet, or research than production. And yet they got rid of their research arm and doing it. Made no sense whatsoever. I was at the Ohio State's dairy farm a few years back, and that was quite impressive, but we continue to have them peeling off left and right. Neil Rodimus, my guest, we're halfway through on a Red Shirt Friday. When we come back, we're going to talk more about what Neil brought up in terms of the feds telling the locals, you're not going to control the land. We are at the local level, and he had a couple meetings this week that we'll talk about when we return with more. Roll out after this. And let's talk about beef. Tender beef at that. Certified Piedmontese is guaranteed tender, and it's guaranteed tender thanks to the myostatin gene. Two inactive copies of the myostatin gene naturally occur in the Piedmontese cattle, otherwise known as double-muscled cattle. What that means to you, the consumer, you have a supply of regionally produced beef, the most nutrient-dense food substance on the planet, delivered to your door. That's what you can do. CertifiedPiedmontese.com for details. Welcome back. We're all out. Trent Luce. Neil Ronimus, my guest, joining us from Southwest Ohio, the Eastern Corn Belt. Neil, you've been sharing with me for quite some time some buzz and chatter about solar development in the area. You mentioned it already. What's going on with that, and what's the local momentum and sentiment?
Well, as I said before, that in Ohio, there's large presence of large scale solar. And, you know, a lot of us don't agree with it. Some of our neighbors do. And, as a rule for the state of Ohio right now, we're about 45,000 acres under construction or under permit, or under the application process. In my county, in my area, there's about six projects ongoing or under that process. And in Ohio, if you're under 50 megawatts, you don't have to comply with the Ohio Power Siting Board's regulations or go through the permitting process. And the one in our area is 300 megawatts, which encompasses about 3,500 acres of actual land.
That is currently, what was that land currently used for? What kind of land are they putting them on?
It's cropland, flat cropland. They
really?
They love to construct on large flat areas so they don't have to, you know, interfere with changing the land, and it's convenient, and it's like a farmer farming a field.
So if this is cropland, you have a willing landowner who's said, yes, I want to do this.
Correct. He's said yes to either a sale to a company that wants to purchase the land for such thing, or says yes to a lease for approximately what could be 30-year lease to the company. So they get paid by the acre per year for the use of their land for that time period.
So how do you, I'm troubled by this, and it's the same argument with wind. You know, we've been fighting wind development for a long time, and fighting it, I mean, I try to be as big a proponent for property rights as you can possibly be. So this gentleman, assuming it's a guy, this person that owns this land can do with his property what he sees fit. The problem that we have is that we know the subsidies required for wind and solar make it not a wise choice for energy production as a nation. So as a taxpayer, I don't want to be a part of subsidizing a system that's really doing nothing other than taking land out of food production. But I can't go to that guy and tell him, hey, you shouldn't do that with your property because it's his property. He can do what he sees fit. How do you rationalize all of that, and how does that tie into public sentiment and what you've been fighting, Neil?
Well, it's a very good point, you know, and I always say that we interfere with each other's property rights all the time. Mm-hmm. Should I build a hog barn? I have a little bit of an influence on the environment short term, or that's been a fact of life, you know. Also, if I have a 2-acre piece of land, and the person moves in there, has a little piece of land. And in this case, some of these houses that we're opposing the project in can be surrounded by four sides of solar panel fields and fence up to 50 feet from their property line. You know, and that's not a property right. You're infringing on that homeowner or landowner because – you know, it's a kind of a NIMBY thing, but yes, it's justified, not in my backyard. So they work through the process to lessen that. So they want to put up buffer strips and trees. And when the first salesman came to my house, he said, well, we'll put trees all around. I says, look, I've been working for 30 years to tear trees out of my fence line so I could farm them. And you want to plant the darn things. So we kind of had a laugh about that, but in all sincerity, locally in this project, in our county, our commissioners have decided it's not what they want for our county. So they have opposed the pilot project, which is payment in lieu of taxes. So they make a deal in the process to get some money up front from the solar construction company to proceed with the project, which allows them to operate this plant. We call it a plant because it is. It's got, you know, this project is going to encompass about 8 landowners, about 3,500 acres, and it'll all be fenced in or connected because obviously you have to connect them to a high tension lines, which are available in our area because the coal plants are being shut down along the Ohio River. We're 2 counties away from the Ohio River. So, you know, that's why the transmission lines run through our area several places. So that makes it attractive at that point. In our county, I said they oppose it. So yesterday, the Ohio Power Siting Board, the actual board that approves that, made up of 6 members of the committee, which is the DNR director, the director of development, the director of health, the Ohio director of EPA, and the Ohio director of agriculture, plus 1 public member, which could be a state senator or a congressman. I can't tell you who this gentleman is. But during the process, you start the application, and I got the book, and it's 6 books that stack about – each one's about 8 to 10 inches thick, so there's 6 mm-hmm. of them. That's how many pages it takes to research and all the stuff that the company has to meet for the – staff of the Ohio Power Siting Board to go through, make sure that they've done this. Having said all that, the staff approves it and then presents it to the board to vote on. So yesterday they voted unanimously, I believe, I'm sure they did, to allow a certificate to be presented to the Yellowwood LLC project. So it can go forward in the construction process. However, our county trustees have listened and done research of their own and traveled to other states where they see this and our own area, because in Highland County, there's 6 projects, 2 are under construction and 1 is operating. They wanted to see how this worked out. And they see that there's no monitoring of this situation. It's just an approval process. So therefore, they don't want to issue – it's a tax abatement is what the pilot project is. So going forward there, the project's been approved. However, in our state, nobody has went forward with the project without the pilot project. And it's a very touchy issue because, as you said, pilot, not pilot, I'm sorry, property rights, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The people in this project around my farm, I've either known them before they was born. I either grew up with them, worked for their parents on these farms. You know, we have a very close relationship with many of them, and it's been a very tough go here to oppose some of your best friends, you know. However, I think there's some daylight there that even some of them may be skeptical of what they've gotten into. But you know, we get to be really careful that we don't attack each other because we do have that close relationship. And also we have some other people in that are absentee landowners. They may have owned it for three or four generations, but they don't live there and they don't farm it. It's just a leased out land to the people that, of course, farm the land. So it's been a very touchy subject. And, you know, there are family members that will not speak to each other right now because of this, you know, and that's a darn shame. So here you got a subsidized program to operate. It's just, you know, it's really making it difficult on people.
You know, Neil, I've decided, because it's been a long battle, and I've witnessed this with wind, and now solar all of a sudden is the push. And I've decided that what you just brought up is the real motivation, and that nobody can argue that there's a blatant attempt to control this country, the people within this country, from top to bottom. And we know the answer to resisting that is local control. And yet, bringing about these, I'm going to call them alternative subsidized energy sources, has created more division within communities than anything. You've never had a dairy barn built that caused the division that we have here. Yet they have figured out that we can cripple these local areas by pitting neighbors against neighbors, family members against family members, and that makes us weaker. It looks like to me that is the overall agenda.
I agree. That's what is actually happening. You know, the county next to us has all these projects, and the commissioners, they welcome it. They want them all. They want every one of them. However, one of the commissioners was a former ODA director in Ohio. You know, he sat on that board. And another thing, this power siting board was developed for oil and gas in the 50s or 60s, you know. It wasn't designed to handle what's going before them now. And I think a lot of them are starting to take a look at that. And, you know, you can get the money. You know, that's what they're in it for, the county next to us, which is Highland County. They want all the money they can get. If you drive through some of those projects, they're done, you know, as far as the panels aren't there yet. But it looks like a drive-in theater with all the poles for rows and rows for miles, and the weeds have grown up, you know. So they've come up to a stumbling block that they can't get the panels installed. So, you know, that they're not making them fast enough, or they're coming from, you know, however they're supposed to be making it some more in this country. But it all goes down to local control, you know, and the people have spoke to those commissioners in a lot of detail in these projects, and they still are putting a rubber stamp on them. And we also have what we fought for was Senate Bill 52. It was opposed to all of our commodity groups. It was to give some local control to local people in these projects. Well, the commodity groups opposed it because they said this is the next step to controlling agriculture production and building of hog barns, dairy farms, et cetera. Well, I didn't buy that. I said, you know, well, maybe there's something to this, you know. But however, the one case I know that went through the new process, our process is grandfathered in because it's already started. So it didn't fall under Senate Bill 52. So to that board, it added a county commissioner from that area and a trustee, township trustee. So the one that I know about, the trustee went to the hearing in Columbus. He votes no. Everybody else votes yes. So I'm wondering, we just wasted our time and money there getting that passed. However, my question is, if the commissioner had opposed it, the trustee had opposed it, could any of the others been swayed? You know, there's only been two denied in the whole process since it started. Two projects denied.
That's kind of telling in itself, Neil Ronimus. We have to take a break. We'll be back for the last segment, Roll Route, after this. Tales about the Certified Piedmontese system, certifiedpiedmontese.com. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Lewis on a Redshirt Friday. Neil Ronimus joining us from Ohio. And usually, you know, you have this team of fact checkers. Neil actually fact checked himself during the break. There's three. You said this. No, I didn't do it. You said, actually, there's three approved projects, not two.
Three denied.
Three denied. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Only three denied since we started this in the last few years.
That's pretty telling.
And there are 27 approved projects. 12 are approved under construction, and 3 are operating.
When did this start?
As far as us being exposed, it's sometime around 19, because a lot of the public hearings had to be Zoomed because of COVID in 2020 when right. I was a township trustee. Mm-hmm. So we heard things. We didn't think nothing about it, and we even had a salesman came to my house, and I could have got $62,000 a year if I signed up my farm. And another time he came back and wanted to put a easement across my property to connect two properties. It was in the six figures. So, well, I can't tell you what I said, but I basically told him, you know, first you got to find somebody that's willing to sell out, and then you got to dicker on the price. But I have another story that better not tell. But anyway, you know, I just told him, hit the road. You know, so we didn't think nothing of it, and we got letters, and then finally the process starts going, and, you know, our neighbors have signed up this, and the project actually grew over the next 2 years to include another farm behind me. And, you know, and it's not a jealous thing. People think it's because of the mass amount of money. You know, they're actually approaching the cost of the land, because we have land in our area selling from $8,000 to $16,000 an acre, you know. So it's really not that good of a deal. I mean, in the long-term picture, you know, it's all about what's the land for, you know, and I've, like I said, I've walked some of this land and worked it and worked for the people that owned it. And I know that those older generations wouldn't want nothing to do with this. I mean, I'll just guarantee you, you know, I knew them that well. So.
The Department of Energy, some time ago, like February, reported that they had a plan to put between 2 and 3 million acres under solar panel. Neil, what you're describing is happening all over this country. In fact, yesterday there was a new issue came out from the Biden administration that they're going to do an incentive to do solar panels in a big way on federal land. And you're talking about just in your county, 3,500 acres. When I was in southwest Minnesota earlier this year, they're talking about a 2,600 acre contiguous solar panel project. There is no way this is only a two, three million acre project nationwide, when every area of the country I know of has somebody proposing and trying to put thousands and thousands of acres under solar panel. And when you put into context what you've already shared, and I know is happening in most places, they're taking food production out to put in a solar panel. And now I have people talking, well, but I can still graze around these solar panels. You're not going to graze around these solar panels. I'm just here to tell you, you're not going to do it. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
This is a major food security issue for the nation. And
it is.
And I have to say, you got to get major kudos to you for being there's somebody there offering you $62,000 and more. And yet you stand on your principles and say, no, I am not going to do that because it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's good to have some encouragement, because, like I said, we actually have to face our good friends and neighbors in opposing this, you know. And you know, some of our friendships may or may not survive, you know, and that's just saying a lot from generations of working together and friendships, you know. And then plus, you know, but we've decided that come what may, we'll deal with it, you know, just like Any other time, we'll just have to haul a little manure a little farther. We'll have to deal with construction traffic for a couple of years, and then we'll deal with it best we can. But, you know, the local communities, will they survive? Because you start talking further down the road, even though most of our crop supply inputs come from large companies anymore. I call it the one I call the Walmart of agriculture, you know. Oh, I shouldn't have said Walmart. But anyway, ding me for
the
that.
The place you don't go, so we'll disqualify that.
Okay. Well, we have those in the big conglomerate ag companies that sell to us. But we have no choice because we've lost our local guy that came out and did it. But, you know, having said that, there's a lot of jobs and inputs that'll be leaving when you talk about the kind of acres, especially in Highland County, that are falling under these projects. There's a lot of sales that they're going to leave, and they won't come back for 30 years. And, you know, that's another thing that's been talked about.
Neil, you put that into context very well, because I'm sitting here thinking about just yesterday, I saw an article that was clearly written by a wind developer, and the article was talking about O'Brien County, Iowa, up in north central Iowa. And the whole article's context was, this is the best thing ever for the local school, for the county commissioners. This wind development initiative in O'Brien County has brought a windfall, pun intended, a windfall of revenue through taxes into the county, and things are just wonderful. Well, the neighboring county to O'Brien County is Hancock County. I was just there last week, and it was 2 weeks ago now. I sent the chairman of their county commissioners a note, and I said, hey, look at this. What do you have to say about this? And Sis Griman right away got me three other counties that would have the exact opposite be true. And in fact, I should find her quote, but there was a small tax block influx for the first few years, 2 years maybe, and then just nothing. And what you just said, that makes perfect sense. Any land, even if it's pasture land, I don't care what it is, you are producing something over a period of time from an economic standpoint of that county. When you're talking about the construction phase, there's going to be 1,000 jobs in the construction phase. And when they're done, they're gone, and there's no economic output. It just sits there doing nothing. You don't produce anything because you can't even store, you can't find the components to build a battery to store the electricity. I stopped by DeKalb, Illinois. In DeKalb, Illinois, there's a Meta Center. And that's another, you know, four-letter word we shouldn't be saying on the air. But anyway, on the south side of this Meta Center is a fantastic farm. It's called Whiskey Acres, and the family's just doing a phenomenal job using their own grain to make whiskey. I had a fantastic time. And then he started telling me about what they were going to do in terms of building all of these subsidized solar panels to feed the Meta Center. And it was on his properties, and their power was free. I'm trying to remember this on the fly. Their power was free. And if they had more to the Meta Center than what they actually use, which they're anticipating, then they get like 10% of the value of what it costs to buy it. I'm like, who designed this plan? It certainly wasn't somebody that understands supply and demand and economics. This is designed to be one-sided and not be beneficial to anybody in the local area. And yet they're hoodwinking people in because they dangle a little bit of money. Trust me, I need some revenue to keep this thing running here, but I just take tremendous you as a role model to say, no, we're going to do the right thing because you're not productive. You're taking this productive land out of production by covering it up with a solar panel, period.
Some of the most productive ground in the state is being constructing panels because they're feeding the A company, and the G company is wanting it, you know, out of the Columbus. And the big guy that owns all the farmland, he owns a lot of this land up there in that area. I'm not real familiar with where, but it's in the Madison County area up towards Columbus even more. But, you know, the G and the A companies going for that deal. So that's what's driving a lot of that out in those areas. However, in our place, one of these projects was purchased by the city of Cincinnati. The land was purchased and it was built for them, and the power is going directly to Cincinnati. because it's part of their goal for the crime family that's running the White House to, you know, to meet that zero footprint deal, which they never will, because as we know that anything like that, they always keep moving the target. You know, you can't ever hit that target because they're going to keep moving it by the time you get there.
Absolutely. You know, this is becoming a serious trend. You have Cincinnati buying farmland, taking it out of production to not even to generate electricity, just to meet some formula that they've been told they have to meet for net zero carbon. You know, Chuck Miller would tell us if he was here, we have towns, cities in Colorado buying farmland so that they can have access to the water rights that come along with that. At some point, Neil, people are going to wake up and say, wait a minute, the cities, and Hank, look at Hank Vogler. Every week on Monday on this program, we talk about Southern Nevada Water Authority, the city of Las Vegas, trying to buy land and take the water resources away from the food producers. You continue to remove the resource from the food producers. What's the end result, Neil?
Population reduction.
We have 1 minute left. What's your bit of optimism for the day?
Just keep going, keep struggling, just like we always have. Fight the battle when we can, and I like your favorite ending every day that you give.
On this program?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm 30 seconds from giving it. Unless you'd like to give it today, that'd be good.
I'll say it backwards.
That's okay. You're from Ohio. You're forgiven.
Be firm, stay gentle. That's not right.
Be gentle, stay firm. It's written right there.
Oh, right there it is.
Right there, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm not a horseman or a muleman, but, you know, I was on the right end of the pig most of the time. So.
Yeah.
Be gentle, stay firm.
It's those times that you're not on the right end of the pig that you get in trouble. Trust me, we've been there.
You know, I've been in the cattle business, so I learned a lot from that when I was young. So,
yeah.
Thanks for having me on here, Trent.
Thanks, Neil. Great to see you last week. We've successfully journeyed down the road, connecting food producers to food consumers. For Neil Ronimus and myself, I'm Trent Luce. All roads do lead to a roll route. See you Monday. Have a great weekend. I've been taking a look back into the history of the National Western Stock Show back to 1906 when it began. It's all about celebrating culture. You know, I think it's time we get back to the National Western in January 2024 and celebrate the culture of taking care of resources and utilizing the resources of this nation to improve human lives. Celebrating culture is the key. I mean, let's face it, we are in the world of agriculture. Let's get back to the cultural celebration. NationalWestern.com for details.